Namaste, Jai Hind. Welcome to another edition of the ANI podcast with Smita Prakash. This episode is being filmed in the heart of Delhi at the Raisina Dialogue 2024. The Raisina Dialogue 2024 is India's premier multilateral conference, bringing in diplomats, politicians, thought leaders from around the world. For anyone interested in foreign policy, this is a red letter day. Today's topic is, has the state surrendered to the street? The democratic world has been rocked by protests that attempt to force through political and institutional change without the sanction normally provided by elections and legislatures. This panel will examine whether this is a natural development and how democracies should respond. The panelists in today's discussion are James Carafano, Vice President, Davis Institute for National Security and Policy, the Heritage Foundation, USA, and Gladden Papin, President, Hungarian Institute of International Affairs, Hungary. Dr. Carafano, thank you. Barely had the world come out of a pandemic and it has to confront with the Russia-Ukraine war, the Israel-Hamas conflict, and how are democracies now going to cope with this street protests which are coming out? Because with the Israel-Hamas conflict, you're seeing in Europe, the governments have a certain view, whereas the street has a different view. So how are democracies dealing with this?
Yeah, so I actually don't see this as a street issue. If you look globally, and this explosion of kind of anti-Israeli sentiment that's sprung up, I don't think it's spontaneous and I don't think it's organic. I think it's the result of global networks that have really been building out the infrastructure to pull the trigger on this. And this is definitely a modern phenomenon. So what we're seeing really, I think, is inattention to the issues of anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism that's been manifested with cash and networks globally for decades, and October 7th, somebody just pulled a trigger, and that's really what got us where we are. So this question is, I think, much more significant than just the street versus what governments want. What we have here, I think, is a very, very extensive infrastructure of non-governmental actors and surrogates who build in global networks, so everything now is a global competition.
Do you agree with that, the pressure of the street on democracies?
Well, it is a very complex issue, and I think that Dr. Carafano is right that there's a lot of action is backed by money forces and also the effects of these international networks that are able to materialize somewhat spontaneously. But certainly there is also a larger issue about the relationship between popular viewpoints and the decisions of governments, because on a lot of particular issues, whether or not they have manifested in protests, we find that there is a disjunction between opinion polls and popular judgments and the decisions that have been made by governments. For example, in Europe, at least, there's been a lot of surveys that show that most European publics feel that the sanctions policies that have been implemented since the beginning of the Russian invasion of Ukraine have been detrimental to their own economic condition. This is only a couple of countries, I think, Norway, Denmark, Finland, UK, think otherwise. But you would find almost no reflection of this in popular at the governmental level or at the level of political discourse. And I think if we step back and look at the last few years of major political decisions, oftentimes it feels to people that governments make a bad decision and then the issue set just moves on to another topic. So at least in Europe, which is where I live from America originally, but living in Europe now, it seems that there is an increasing disjunction between the issues that are bothering and motivating a lot of European publics and the sort of political discourse that is taking place at the elite level. This is a little bit separate from the issue of large popular protests on specific issues. They're related somehow, but there are I think problems or issues that are coming up in the functioning of contemporary democracy.
Can I just follow up on that? Because I think it's a really important point. So there are two phenomena going on simultaneously. One is the one that I discussed, which is really the weaponization of the street, which is political actors putting people out on the street to push for certain outcomes. What Gladden is saying, I think, is a phenomenon which, interestingly, he lives in Hungary now, you live in India, you guys aren't experiencing this, and that is the dissatisfaction of people with their governments. And it's particularly a problem in the U.S. and Europe. We are a 50-50 country, so we are deadlocked at the federal level. So there is this great frustration that government is not delivering on what people see. In Europe, you have a different set of problems because they have parliamentary governments. What you often see in what I call Frankenstein governments, right? So what you wind up with is kind of a right-left coalition because nobody has enough to have a majority. And so you have a government that really can't deliver on anything, right? Because if they do, they'll lose their coalition. And so we see conservative governments, for example, that take power, and they, and I think Poland's a good example, they don't really deliver as conservatives because they don't have the political coalition to do that, and people are deeply frustrated. You know, in Hungary, you have a government which has a very large majority and delivers on the interests of its people. It doesn't have that problem. India doesn't have that problem. It has a government which has a political majority, and it allows them to drive their agenda. But in many countries, because of this deep political discord, you cannot say, well, for example, I'm a conservative government, but then you're actually never delivering any conservative policies because you can't build a majority in your government to do that.
You're seeing that in Canada too, right? You have a liberal government and...
Well, Canada's a really interesting example. And in many ways, we don't like to say this because we don't like to admit we know each other, but in many ways, Canada and the United States are identical in current things we have. So in both cases, we have very liberal governments who took power and adopted very, very, really powerful, strong agendas in one direction, even though their countries are not all in agreement with that. So in the United States, we're a 50-50 country, but we have a government that's governing as if it has a supermajority and a mandate from the people. I think we've seen the same thing in Canada. What I see in Canada is unbelievable. I mean, the oppression of civil liberties, the intrusion of identity politics in a country that is really at its heart very, very moderate and actually conservative, and is being turned into a country that doesn't even recognize itself. And so I think that's why you see that this, and what's holding this government together, right? Which is a very liberal government with a small faction, and indeed the government could well fall because the small faction's not getting what it wants.
Here in Canada, what we're seeing is we're not seeing street protests, but we are seeing a different kind of pressure tactic which is being applied, and you're seeing the manifestation. See, let's get into America now. We've seen the Black Lives Matter. So, Dr. Pappin, you know, whether it is in Canada, which we discussed, or whether it is in Netherlands, maybe, and whether we are seeing it in America, the street protests, how much pressure can a democratically elected government withstand, and where do they bend? What do you think?
Well, let's think about some of the largest political actions that were in the streets in the U.S. in the last few years, because I think what we would find is that even the analysis of street protests has become highly politicized and charged in the U.S. If we go back to the 2020 election, well, there was a lawfully elected president between 2016 and 2020, or, you know, beginning of 2021. And in the middle of 2020, there were the COVID policies, right? So everyone was supposed to basically stay at home, except a gigantic carve-out was made for the BLM protests that summer.
Yeah.
You know, you couldn't go to your local baseball park to have a Little League baseball match. But massive numbers of people were able to take to the streets with the involvement of Antifa forces, in a clear involvement of like larger political actors who were trying to use this for greater purposes. And it was basically either heralded in the media or the violence that was occurring was being covered up. I'm not talking about the underlying issues here of police brutality or whatever in this or that case. I'm just talking about analyzing it on a political level. Now, this was considered to be and analyzed as like a classic example of genuine American protest. It was obviously something that involved a much deeper level of political intent and coordination by important actors, because there was a kind of conspiracy of silence around the huge violation of the norms that the rest of society had to undergo. And the purpose was obviously to make the political situation around President Trump unbearable and eventually cause him to fall. Now, of course, what happened on January the 6th of 2021 is something different, and involved a lot of very serious problematic elements. Nevertheless, from the media level, none of the major commentators, none of major left liberal commentators were sitting back and saying the protesters in the summer had some legitimate concerns, and the protesters right now had some legitimate concerns. Mm. No, these were treated in a completely opposite manner. There were very few prosecutions brought against all the violent protesters who had engaged in, rampant looting and destruction of cities the past summer. But, every single person who was even remotely somehow involved with the incidents, which of course were very bad on January 6th, was hounded. So in the U.S. at least, I think you can find from the example of 2020 and early 2021 that there are clearly much larger political forces that were at work determining how these street actions would be oriented, what purposes they would serve, whether they would be lionized or persecuted. So it's nothing is purely organic in those
not
responses.
Organic.
Yeah, I think that's a good illustration of another example of the weaponization of the street as opposed to rise of popular protests because you have legitimate issues with governance.
So when you can weaponize street protests, use the media to weaponize street protests, as you mentioned, Dr. Papin. Dr. Carafina, I want to ask you whether these can be used by foreign forces to destabilize governments, and that's something that one has to watch out, especially in nascent democracies.
I think it's a real issue, and it's not just an issue for nascent democracies. BLM is a Black Lives Matter is a good example. If you look at the leaders of Black Lives Matter, these are all people who were educated in elite universities by many professors who were radical leaders in the 1960s. Most of these individuals have connections and training in Marxist-Leninist ideology. Many of them studied in Cuba. They studied in China. There was Chinese money that flowed into the infrastructure that built the BLM infrastructure in the United States. So clearly, there are foreign actors that support this as well. So weaponization of the street is a global is a global weapon.
Would you, Dr. Papin, say that Hungary is unique in being different? It enthusiastically welcomes in conservatives and conservative thought, people who have conservative thought. Is it different from the rest of Europe?
Yes, it is. And I think Dr. Carafano made a good point about that as well. Since 2010, Hungary has had a conservative government and it's won 4 back-to-back elections at a two-thirds majority level. So it's exactly right that the type of politics that's able to occur there is different from from other governments in which there's a highly divided coalitions. But Hungary has not lacked for attempts at foreign interference in its elections as well. The most recent election in Hungary was in spring of 2022. Again, there too, Prime Minister Orban won a two-thirds majority. There was a number of opposition parties, and since the time of the election, it's emerged that they enjoyed millions of dollars in foreign financial funding. This was all illegal. There's no possibility for foreign funding of elections, and this was mainly coming from elements of the George Soros network, which has become, in Hungary we know very well. It's known very well in the U.S. as well,
and
in India, and in recent months, all the details have been come out. But there was basically, even in Hungary, an attempt at a kind of color revolution or fostering of specific opposition parties from outside. So it's something that's clearly occurring everywhere. There are a lot of of sneaky means through which funds can be transferred internationally through different organizations. And
so follow the money, right?
Yeah, follow the money,
well,
sure.
And it's also a reflection, again, of this modern political warfare, which is exactly what it is, political warfare. It's like you don't see the distinction, for example, between governments that somebody may not like winning elections over and over again. Those are considered threats to democracy. So the fact that in India, a prime minister wins term after term after term, and if you don't like that government, well, it's a threat to democracy. Hungarian president's a threat to democracy because he keeps winning elections. In the U.S., the notion of somebody other than a Democrat winning is a threat to democracy. And we throw that into the same camp as a president for life, who where there is no transparency, there is no civil society, there is no media, and the system is entirely rigged to ensure elections. This is really, really dangerous, right? Yeah. Because what we're doing is in the name of pushing political warfare, we're obscuring the notion of what democracy is about and what makes it. It doesn't. Democracy is not, if the guy that wins isn't my guy, that's a threat to democracy. Democracy is about human beings having an opportunity to choose their own leaders and make their own decisions. And it's terrible to see the weaponization against elections that don't turn out right as far as other people are concerned.
2 points that which I want to, which you were mentioning about, foreign influence. We haven't heard that as yet about the American elections. But before that, I want to pick on what we were talking about, which is that if my guy doesn't win, then it's not a democracy. And is that why research after research is showing that more than 50% of Americans do not believe in the kind of democracy, don't have trust in the electoral process? Why is that happening? I mean, everybody looks around the world, everybody looks at a functioning democracy. An example of functioning democracy is America, where peaceful transition of power happens after an election. But if a majority of Americans don't believe in the electoral process, don't believe in their own presidency and the ability of an elected government to deliver on their promises, then there is something to worry about, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of a good news, bad news. So the bad news is, I'm not a Republican and I'm a Democrat. I'm politically independent. I work at a nonpartisan foundation. So none of my comments are meant to disparage one side or the other. But the reality is there are people in the U.S. government using the instruments of government as political weapons. That undermines constant trust in democracy. So if you didn't feel those concerns from Americans, then I would think that there's something wrong in democracy, right? Mm-hmm. The good news is, you know, in terms of foreign interference, we say, oh, people are spending money or having influence. This is the world's largest economy. We spend so much money and so much time and so much media on our elections that honestly, foreign interference is like, dude, get in line. That's just really noise. We spend so much time trying to confuse ourselves that I don't think other people really are very successful at that. But I think the biggest point is the strength of U.S. democracy. And this is where my confidence comes from, because our system really is structured. There are no structure is people-proof. Evil people can destroy any country. But the United States has some very powerful checks and balances. So everybody famously knows, we have a separate judiciary, we have a separate legislative body and a separate executive. There's a lot of political warfare that's put that system under tremendous pressure. But the other system that the United States has, which is incredibly powerful, is this division of power between the federal and the state level. Mm. So why we have stagnation in Washington and a lot of kind of backstabbing, out in the states, people are making decisions for themselves, and that's having a profound effect on America's future. And we see this incredible divergence between what's happening, for example, in a New York and a California and a Florida and Texas. That allows the political system to keep churning. It also allows a certain kind of pressure to let off for people to find places where they can energize their activity and concern. So the challenge for the United States is that we are this is a good thing, I think, in America, and we have this periodically through history. We are a 50-50 country.
Which means?
That half of the people disagree with the other half of the people. Uh-huh. But what's important about that is it's not just, you root for the Yankees, I root for the Red Sox. We have two political parties which have come to represent very divergent visions for the future of the country. So it's not just about, well, let's just get together and cut a deal, because they want to go in very, very different directions. I find this exciting because Americans have when you go to the ballot in the United States now, you have a real choice. You get to go that way or that way. And I think that's a much clearer and decisive choice. So I think what will happen in the United States is, and we've seen this in the past couple of elections, and we'll do it in a few more, is we will fight this out. Somebody's going to win. And we will wind up being a center-right country or a center-left country. And then the losing political party is going to have to reform, reorganize, or do something or whatever. I don't see this as a sign of, I mean, there are challenges of political warfare. I don't see this as a sign of American democracy is coming apart. I see this as a sign as American democracy is fighting its way to get to the position of what's best for Americans. And so I think we're actually going to come out of this.
So sitting in Europe, do you see this churn as something positive?
Well, I think that is true, and there are a number of important points that Dr. Carafano has raised. And I lived most of my life in the U.S., so I'm now a lot of political memories are coming to mind. But actually, the transformation of the Republican Party under President Trump and the movements that surround that have been one of the biggest changes in American politics. It's come from a popular place, you know, people called it initially a kind of populist rebellion within the Republican Party or something like that. But it is an emblem of how a certain kind of good political change within the structure of the American system can come about. Basically, the situation in 2016 is that a lot of conservative Republicans felt that the Republican Party was not representing the issues that they considered the most important. So what were the issues that President Trump put on the agenda in 2016 that people hadn't really felt were there? Immigration, loss of jobs, competition with China. Like these were, and a general sense of national pride and maybe criticism of excessive foreign American military interventions that had gone wrong. Those were basically the issues. And there were huge rallies. People waited outside for 12 hours to see him. Why? Because there was very little or inadequate representation of that within the Republican Party. He had power for 4 years. He tried to change a lot of elements, and there was a huge amount of pushback from different parts. He lost dramatically. He was politically destroyed, and, well, here we are in 2024, and he's going to be the Republican nominee, and he has a stronger hold on more parts of the party than last time. There are more pro-Trump elements at the state level. He's influenced the calculus that Republican politicians have to make everywhere. There was no one single alternative candidate around whom everyone else gathered. So, actually, this is a... at least within the Republican Party, it is an example of how a lot of change can occur from what started as a, you know, burgeoning popular movement, not of course a street protest, but you know, within Republican Party terms, something that's kind of like that. Mm-hmm. And people always ask me, you know, is the U.S. about to enter a civil war because it's so polarized and so divided? And not to echo my colleague's comment, but I usually say, like, it's a gigantic country, and when people were extremely dissatisfied with COVID policies or whatever, or left-wing ideology in California, well, they moved to Texas, and people were saying, yeah, but it's so polarized, like, California is so left-wing and Texas is so right-wing. Is there going to be a war or something? It's like, well, you know, people were extremely dissatisfied living in California. Well, then they move to Texas and Florida and they're less dissatisfied. but nevertheless, there are a lot of national issues here because, of course, America has to make important decisions in the medium term, you know, and not just be racked by political conflict. So there are important larger issues as well.
Yeah, I think it's a global. I think it's actually reflective of a global competition in democracies, and India is actually at the center of gravity. This is two very different visions. The conservative vision, for all the differences of conservatives all over the world, is that governance is something from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. That government's job is to respond to the needs and demands of the people. The liberal vision has morphed into the notion of global governance, that global elites should decide what's best for everybody. And it's really government from the top down. And these are the two divergent choices. So that's why what we're seeing in the United States, we also see in Europe. You know, Viktor Orban is successful in Hungary for one reason, because he's actually doing what Hungarians want the government to do, to deliver for the Hungarian people. Modi is successful in India because he's doing one thing that Indian governments haven't really done for decades. He's actually delivering on the needs and interests and demands of the people. So I think it's the same thing in what we just saw in Argentina.
But when we see think tanks and American media writing, or even European media writing about Modi and Indian governance models, they say that this is like a spiraling downwards, end of democracy in India. We see all that kind of, why is it that that's the narrative?
Because they're on the other side, right? Yeah. Because these institutional organizations and civil society, many of them captured by these global elites, this is part of an orthodoxy, that the notion of global governance and then governance from the top down, that people should be told how to live their lives and how to allocate resources and what success is and what their gender should be and what their family should look like, that they believe this. And therefore, anything that threatens that is a threat to democracy. And of course, this is a complete inversion of the whole notion of democracy. A democracy is about communities deciding their future. Mm-hmm. The whole liberal project is destruction of that idea. And it is the greatest abuse in the world that the terminology of freedom has actually been used as a weapon to destroy freedom.
Do you agree, Dr. Patton?
I think that many liberal governments have made the idea of democracy something like an output rather than an input. So they, in their world, you know, actually in Europe, this there was a strong discussion about this about 20 years ago. The European Union, of course, is a very different entity for the relationship among nations than we find anywhere else in the world. And the question was, well, given that the most powerful decisions, most important decisions in Europe are made by basically unelected bureaucrats, is there a democratic deficit in the European Union? There was this discussion among scholars, and the liberal democratic elites basically came to the conclusion, well, no, there's not a democratic deficit in the European Union. There's not a lack of popular input, because the goal is to have as liberal a liberal democratic output. So as long as marriage laws and gender laws and so forth are being modified in a liberal direction all over Europe, whether or not that's what people want, that's a democratic result. And if 99% of the people of Hungary want to maintain their child protection laws, which is what the surveys say, that's anti-democratic. Right. And so they have this framework in which democracy has a very counterintuitive meaning, compared to the one that you would get if you asked someone on their way to the polls.
You mentioned China, so let's get going with that. Before the earlier election, there was this talk about American election. There was talk about Russian interference, Chinese interference. Yesterday, I had a panel where we were discussing and said when Taiwan elections happened, China wasn't too happy. Pakistan has just had an election and they've not been able to form a government, but China has turned around and congratulated them on successful holding of elections. It's the only country which sees election in Pakistan as being successful when, the guy, the most popular guy in Pakistan is sitting in jail and the other two haven't been able to form a government. So let's get down to that. Why is it that this time around we're not hearing so much about American elections having foreign interference, or will that come about soon?
Well, I mean, I think that if it's become a very politicized issue in the United States. So if it looks like Donald Trump might win the election, then we'll start hearing that there is intense foreign Russian interference in the election. So, after 2016, plenty of Democratic politicians said, this was a stolen election due to Russian interference. And then in 2020, say what you will about Trump's criticisms of the election or problems in the American election process. I don't want to get into the substance of it, but how dare anyone even raise a question about the most sacrosanct process that's ever occurred with zero foreign right? So this is an issue that's become politicized as well, and it's very hard to get to the bottom of it.
Will that happen, Dr. Caffin? Do you agree with Dr. Pepin?
Well, look, I'm not a fortune teller. This does get to this fundamental challenge of what you talk about, about the world being on fire. What is the greatest threat to freedom and prosperity and peace in the world today? It's China. China is the farthest, whatever point is the farthest in the universe from a democracy where people get to decide for themselves their future, China holds that. So the number one enemy of freedom and democracy in the world today. So, and I don't mean to be like mean to my friends on the left or whatever, but part of China's strategy of political warfare is to support and foment anything that undermines the legitimacy and credibility of democracy. And so whether our friends like it or not, often they find themselves fellow travelers with China in accusing their enemies undermining democracy and being threats to democracy. So they're actually doing China's work for them. And so this is a great challenge is, you know, political warfare is so tempting. I mean, who wouldn't want to win always, right? Who wouldn't want to crush their enemies? I get that. But do they realize that in the process of that and destroying their own democracy, that the people they're helping most is China, which would like nothing more than to see doubts of credibility and democracy. So you're right. Only the Chinese would congratulate the Pakistanis on an election. Only the Chinese would be upset about a free and open election in Taiwan. And what do we do is we mimic exactly the kind of behaviors the Chinese do, and we destroy our own democracy. It's not just sad. The question is I guess the real issue. I'm glad because Hungary sees this all the time. Is are they just stupid that they're in common cause with the people who are destroying and destroy them, or do they know that and their quest for power is so obsessive that they just don't care?
Mm-hmm. You know, street protests, to come back to the topic, street protests, we've all read about, we learned it in schools and colleges, that street protests, genuine form of democracy, must have it, keeps government in check. We've learned all that. But we talked about weaponization. We talked about political weaponization also, and especially by foreign agents. With 60-odd countries going to polls and China wanting to influence many of them because it has a prickly relationship with India, with several other countries, Taiwan, we've just seen. Do democracies have to press the reset button on what street protests should be and what they are expected to be?
No, I don't think. I think they should just listen to this podcast. I think this podcast will, no, I'm serious, will save the world. Look, we have a perfect example in the United States. There is a very big difference between the civil rights protests in the 1960s, some of which often got violent and terrible. But that was a true grassroots movement of Americans dissatisfied with how their government was running the country and how people were being treated. That was a movement of people from the bottom up who wanted change. Many people embraced Black Lives Matter because they saw in Black Lives Matter, well, this is just an extension of the civil rights movement, but it was not. This was a movement that was built on infrastructure and money, and it was designed to change a political outcome. And so what people have to be able to do is look at a riot in the street and saying, is this the Euromaidan of people in Ukraine fighting for their freedom? Or is this somebody weaponizing people in the street to achieve a political outcome? Look, I mean, I would say make the right choice when you're looking at this. And the best example of this is perhaps Gaza. Look at Gaza today. It is a desert. Several million people have had their lives completely destroyed because they turned the political governance over to Hamas. And look at the destruction that led to them. And so if you can't make a distinction between why people are in the streets, then you're not going to be able to save democracy.
That's a very pertinent point. Yes.
I was just going to mention something that Hungary is doing on a small scale, which maybe should be considered at a larger scale and in other countries as well. And this was the introduction from the beginning of this year of a sovereignty protection office. And the purpose of the sovereignty protection office was, this was built in response to the realization that a huge amount of foreign funding had come into our elections in 2022. So clearly this is an issue. If democracies are to function, then as much as possible, they should accurately reflect the opinions of their people in Of course, there are many different ways of shaping people's opinions, but in the first and most simplest element, the existing laws should be followed. Right. And so, you know, protests or street actions that comply with laws are lawful, and those that involve rioting and destruction and looting and so on and so forth are not lawful. Mm-hmm. But to what Dr. Carafano said, the world is much more complex in the way that it can these things can be organized than it was during the American Civil Rights Movement, for example. So there are different legal funding and corporate structures that have come up. So it could be that there's a lot of international interference or even domestic money-based interference that is legal. And so although we should follow the laws first and foremost, governments that represent their people should take the time periodically to have a conversation like the one we're having and figure out, well, you know, is the current setup of tax deductible or tax exempt foundations, is the current setup of this causing a massive distortion? Is there a leak point at which this is exposed to heavy foreign interference because this set of financial flows isn't watched or overseen? There are important questions to ask nonetheless, even after we follow the laws.
And also, I think firewalls are necessary when you have something called a sovereignty protection office. Two points which struck me while you were talking was that, one, the sovereignty protection office could work well in a smaller country like, say, a Singapore or Hungary. But can you imagine that working for an India with a 1.4 billion? One, I'll come back to you. And the second point that I want to make is that, you know, in 1970s, we had something like this. Well, a kind of protection against foreign influence, against destabilizing forces. And that was when emergency was imposed in India. And civil rights took a toss. So when that happened, it was seen as a blot on democracy because our freedoms were curtailed. And then there was a correction which happened after that. So this sovereignty protection office could be used by a dictator, you know, in ways to crush civil liberties. So both the points I would like you to see.
Well, first of all, I'm very happy to say that when it comes to what a country of 1.4 billion people should do, that is definitely above my pay grade. So I defer to you. I would say this is a mindset. And so I agree with your analysis. You know, a smaller country is more easily susceptible to dangerous financial inflows. And even in the case of Hungary, you know, there's very limited private financing of election activities. So honestly, it didn't take a huge amount of money in American election terms. Right. You know, it like $10 million and you can cause a huge impact and have a ton of, you can sponsor the biggest political rallies that the country's ever seen, you know, with $10 million, which is like a handful of Senate seats in the U.S. or something like that. But it's a mindset, so that's why yeah, I mean, the Sovereignty Protection Office, whatever, every country should do what's right for it. But the mindset is, well, we should take the opportunity and look at the situation and make sure that the way that the democracy is functioning is genuinely representing the people and hasn't become accidentally open to, you know, an adverse form of activity.
You know, you raise a really important point, which is when you turn over to government the power to protect democracy, you've also turned over to government the power to destroy democracy. Mm. So, and you know, what I've always cherished about the U.S. system is if you look at our Constitution, it has a lot of nice, lovely language in the preamble. You know, it basically says, you know, keep America free, keep it safe, keep it prosperous. But when you look in the Constitution, okay, well, which is the most important? And the Constitution doesn't tell you. Matter of fact, it weighs them all equally. And it does that intentionally. Because if you prioritize any one, it can eventually sacrifice the other two. So it puts these kind of issues in constant tension. Because it always wanted government to struggle to find, to not just a balance between the three, but to find ways to preserve all three because they're all three essential. So I think the most important thing, whether you're talking about the Hungarian example or the Indian example, is there is no permanent solution to this problem. This is a constant struggle. There are always people who are going to want to take over government for the purpose of having power and expressing their all will. And And you cannot create a system that's people-proof. If you put evil people or people in power with wrong intent, they will find ways to pervert the system. So it is this kind of constant struggle, but at the root of it, I think, are the individuals themselves and how much they cherish their own freedoms and their own responsibility. And so, for example, when I look in India and I see the level of political activity, you know, people making a choice to be invested in themselves. When I looked at the United States, for example, Gladden mentioned the rise of kind of populism in the United States, the Tea Parties and et cetera. That is the real safeguard. That is the real line of defense that saves democracy, is individuals who always believe that letting their democracy be run by other people is always going to become to a bad end.
Mm. And we were talking about offense and defense with regard to street protests, and you brought in media also, that the weaponization of media, because media can show a different reason why a certain protest is happening. And that you were pointing out was even during the Black Lives Matter protests, the way it was shown in the media, how media dealt with it. How is that going to happen? How is the American election now going to have those safeguards? Anything, and especially when you see artificial intelligence, social media booming, all the effects of that coming in.
Yeah, well, fortunately in the U.S., we have a system where you cannot control mass media completely. And what we've seen is, you know, the world's greatest philosopher is Jeff Goldblum in the movie Jurassic Park. Mm-hmm. You know, he says life finds a way, right? And this is true.
I like his sense of dressing, nothing else.
As long as this is why people so cherish, you know, basic amendments and the notion that they are inviolable, right? So as long as media is not completely controlled, people will find. I'll give you a very simple example of this. So in the U.S., we have a huge war over gender ideology, which is descended into the fact that in some schools, in order to prove that essentially we're in a genderless world, they insisted on putting tampon dispensers in boys' bathrooms.
Mm.
Okay. A boy went in the bathroom and took it down. The principal of the school was going to have him charged not just with a crime of, like, you know,
vandalism.
He was going to have him charged as a hate crime.
Because
taking down the dispenser meant that he wasn't sympathetic to diversity. You could have diverse genders in the men's room. I don't know.
Oh.
But that story got zero play in mass media, right? But on social media, it got such massive attention, and the school had this massive spotlight put on it that the principal said, never mind. I think in America, we are past the point where mass media can control the narrative.
So it's a natural checks and balances coming into play?
As long as that's there. This is why Presidents for Life are Presidents for Life, right? There is no free media, right? There are no constitutional rights. When you give up those last safeguards, then the system has no corrective capability if people want that. But in a system where you do that, and it just happens in the United States, it's the richest man in the world, bought one of the most influential social media platforms in the United States, and he said, "Hey, have at people," you know. But as long as he can do that and people can do that, then I think democracy does find a way.
What about in Europe? How do you see this in Europe, free media?
Well, I mean, we have European parliamentary elections coming up later this spring, as well as...
There's 15 countries or something going to polls even in Europe,
plus
right?
Plus all of the individual countries. I mean, the media market in Europe is quite different from that in the U.S. because it's still much more national.
Do they impact in the same manner like they impact in the U.S.? Or in India, in fact, does that matter?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think all the same factors are at play. But fundamentally, the media market in Europe is less united. It's more divided. There are different, there are a lot of different languages. So it's quite different and distinct in each country, and so it's a different media landscape. The problem really is at the level of elite opinion and the formation of the options that are available to people. So there's a lot of, I'm not expressing this point quite clearly enough at the moment, but because of the development of European history, there are a lot of existing and legacy parties in Europe that have continued for a long time because of the role and character of the European Union as a powerful super state, the type of discourse that occurs in political circles is somewhat limited and has difficulty, you know, tracking the opinions that are germinating in the ordinary people. And also because of different portions of European history, there's like a very harsh judgment that the system imposes on right-wing parties. So there's more and more, I would say, just this is a kind of general observation across a lot of countries, but there's been more and more divergence between what ordinary people are thinking about, mm-hmm. even people who've been voting for European parties for a long time, and where those parties have gone. And that disjunction hasn't yet, switched into a new system. Basically, what I'm saying is that a lot of the most important policies that have been pursued at the European level in the last few years have been pretty unpopular. Energy prices have gone up dramatically because of the sanctions.
Yeah.
Job opportunities for young people are very limited. There's an increasing rise in right-wing parties because there's a reaction to the disastrous migration decisions that were made in 2015 and so on and so forth. But the system has a very difficult time dealing with this in Western Europe at the moment.
But we're not seeing any pushback to the migrant crisis. For example, you talked about the Israel-Hamas conflict. We're seeing this huge pro-Hamas or anti-Israel demonstrations happening in the UK, in many cities in Europe, but it's not resulting in any difference as far as the governments there are concerned, despite that.
Well, right? I mean, there is actually. I mean, I think that there's a general understanding, even among non-right-wing governments in power, that yes, actually the decisions that were made in 2015,
10 years ago,
were the results are not what we anticipated. How do we improve our security situation? You know, what do we do? And the answers aren't necessarily there, but the awareness, I think, behind the scenes that some bad decisions were made is there. Obviously, Italy voted in favor of a conservative government under Giorgia Meloni, and you can say what you will about how their migration policy has gone since then, but clearly there was a popular expression of concern about this. And looking at the poll numbers in the European election, obviously the Rassemblement National in France has very strong poll numbers. This is right-wing sort of anti-immigration party, and similar phenomena are happening elsewhere in Europe as well.
I'll take concluding remarks. Yes.
No, because these are both two very, very good examples of the phenomenon that we've been discussing here, climate and migration. And examples, I think, of the two divergent views of the world. So, migration, for example, is the global elites believe that establishing a right to migration is critical to global governance. Mm-hmm. The people that oppose that are the narrative is if you oppose that, you're racist. Well, that shuts down all conversation, right? The reality is virtually all the people who are opposed to mass migration are not opposed to it because they're racist. They're opposed to it because it is a tool, it is a weapon that's used to destabilize and undermine their own countries. Mm. Climate is another good example. The people that press for climate change are really not interested in dealing with the climate. They're interested in controlling the world. And the climate policy is an instrument to do that. We all want to save the planet. We all want better climate. We all want better environment. But we also all want affordable, reliable, dependable energy. Mm. I mean, the difference in the conservative view is addressing climate and energy issues, not as an instrument of global control, but as an instrument of how can we actually deliver better outcomes for people.
Right.
And I think that's the frame of the debate.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Carfano. Thank you, Dr. Papin. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for watching or listening into this conversation. Do like or subscribe on whichever channel you have seen this or heard this. Namaste. Jai Hind.